outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gene. The God Gene. The God Gene.
I guess I should start by saying happy birthday.
Oh, yeah, really?
Can I start that way?
Happy birthday the day we record, but it's going to be, gosh, 2.5 weeks, probably 3 weeks before this actually airs. So no more birthday greetings from you guys getting the chef away for another year. But, yeah. My feeds are full of all kinds of greetings today, so I'm not going to get much else done.
Oh, except, see, that's a great way to start the day.
Well, it'll make it a full day. It's not just starting the day.
Yes.
My day, I've got 100 things to do, but I probably won't get done with any of them because I get these wonderful emails from all over the planet and people I love and care about, so I can't just let them go by without trying to respond to as many as I can. So.
Yes, it's a nice day. Feel loved.
And I've got some deadline stuff I was supposed to get done today, but I'm not going to get it done anyway. That's my daughter, Julie. She's back on the podcast with me. I'm
Hello.
Wayne Jacobson. This is The God Journey. And it's kind of a special podcast because we have a special guest joining us, author of a book called Burden of Promise. Her name is Relaine Fagoni. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, I have known Relaine for... gosh, 40 plus years. I have to say how long. You were just, I don't remember how old you were when we met, but you were like college or something when.
You know, Wayne, the first time I think I remember is like I was 10.
10?
And
oh my
we
gosh.
Were at your parents' house when the charismatic renewal was breaking out.
Oh,
and
that's right.
Your
way
parents
before
had a meeting at the house. But my greater memory is when you were my youth pastor.
Oh my gosh.
For a short time.
Oh gosh.
We didn't talk about those things, Relaine. That was that lasted about 3 months, I think, and then I failed as a youth pastor. That was quick for me, but yeah.
Well, every time I read in the scriptures about the propitiation, or if I even said that right.
You did. You said it exactly.
That's what you talked about to us high school kids.
Wow, way back then.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Just I was fresh out of the university and touting my knowledge, as they say. I'm glad.
Very good.
I'm glad. No, it wasn't good. I'm glad those days are over. I'm glad Julie missed those days. So, anyway, and we've known your family forever. My family has known yours. Your uncle, right? Dick Mills?
My uncle.
A lot of people
yes.
to this podcast will know Dick. Dick traveled around and gave prophetic words to people using scriptures and memorized a whole bunch of scriptural promises and kind of gave those out to people as God put them on their heart, touched a lot of people's lives, close to our family for a long time. And
yeah.
You're his niece?
I'm his niece. And then my grandmother, you might remember
her,
Pauline.
Sure. Absolutely.
And she's known for... the song "Thou Art Worthy" that has really become pretty
legend.
Popular
yeah, classic.
Chorus.
Yeah, classic.
Yeah, it's a classic.
Yeah, I was going to mention her too. You beat me to it. But yeah, Pauline Mills, heard her sing back in the day a number of times.
Yeah.
And had a real gift. So yeah, I was trying to remember what big song it was. "Thou Art Worthy." Yeah, that was it.
Thou art worthy.
Yeah, awesome. Anyway, Relaine's joining us. She just published a new book. And it's actually, the subtitle is "When Tragedy Becomes a Teacher." So there's a lot of pain in this book, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah.
You want to give them the best story a little bit, or kind of what's behind it?
Sure. Well, it all started one day when my life changed dramatically with a knock on the door by the Clovis police there in Central California wanting to talk to my son. And by the end of the day, he was arrested for murder and put on trial. So that's the journey that I went on with God, feeling like I did the A, B's, and C's of the Christian life, and I didn't think I deserved what took place.
And how long ago was this, just to give people context?
Okay, that was in 2003, so it's a little over 15 years ago.
Okay, and he was convicted?
He was convicted.
First degree murder
in California. It was a felony first degree murder with special circumstances, gave him life without a possibility of parole.
Yeah, so he's serving time now, life without possibility of parole. This was a big story in the Fresno Clovis area. This is a woman who had killed her husband, and James was involved in this, and then put him in a barrel full of acid to decompose his body, and then... Well, the police uncovered that pretty quickly. I mean,
it was horrific.
Yeah.
Well, it actually kind of even it did go around the world, and it's been on Dateline NBC. They covered the story.
Yeah, we're going to put that link at the bottom of the podcast. So people who want, so we don't want to talk about the crime necessarily in great detail.
Right.
If you're interested in the backstory of this, we'll put the link there so you can see it. Or you can also read about it in this book, Burden of Promise, that you have available. Why did you write the story? What is it that you wanted to communicate in this book?
Well, first of all, it's like I felt like the Lord told me to. And it was really very hard. And, you know, when you go through something, well, when I went through it, I thought if I can help someone or in the midst of all of what I've gone through, then it would be worth it. If I can take the wisdom that I've received and help pass it on to someone else, that's what motivated me. It was very difficult for me to do because it kept me anchored to the past while writing it.
Yeah, it would be difficult. I gave it to my daughter over the weekend, and she said she couldn't put it down. So that's why I thought it'd be good to have another mother on here and maybe see what kind of comments and thoughts she has. But you really found the story pretty compelling, eh, Julie?
I did, and I think it was just – I think a lot of it was you, Raylene, because it was just your – you put your heart into the book, like your the good, the bad, what you were feeling, you're angry, you're – whatever. And there was, in the middle of all of that, I was so touched by the way that you just loved your son through all of that.
Oh, and Julie, thank you.
I think as parents, it's so hard when our kids, I mean, it's hard to not kind of have our kids not think that they reflect who we are and be hurt or upset by the mistakes that they made. And you just loved your son so incredibly through the entire process. And that just really spoke to me, just a mother's love and what that can do. And I saw how, you know, through the book, how it changed your son in the midst of all of that. And I just was incredibly touched by that.
Thank you. Thank you. And, you know, a lot of people come through something and they have this glowing testimony. And I thought to write mine while I'm still in the midst of believing for the father to come and do something and to fulfill a promise. And so it's like, how do you do that and still have joy in your life? And I guess basically it's like, I do have a testimony while I'm in the midst, and I'm not over the finish line yet, that makes sense.
Well, life is a journey, I think, for all of us. And I think one of the things that I mean, I love hearing people's stories, but one of the things I hated when I was back in the young days of going to church was testimony time, because testimonies were always so simplistic and everything turns out great and everybody shares things when they're always good.
That's it.
But most of us live life in the dirt. You know, most of us live life with, and I think one of the things, I haven't read the whole book cover to cover. I've read a bunch of it. What comes through is these moments of getting your hopes built up. It looks like there's going to be a good outcome here. Something's going to be really good. And then, boom, it just crashes again. And nothing good results from some of the difficult choices that had to be made in the whole justice system, which having touched a little bit of it in a lawsuit we had a while back, really realizing this is just a game. Nobody cares about what's true. Nobody cares about what's right. No one cares about what's fair. It's all prosecutors are playing a game with defense attorneys. Everybody's trying to win, but nobody really cares about justice. I think that comes through in the book. It's just that's not what people are wanting.
No.
Unfortunately.
It was a real eye-opener. And so I was exposed to a lot of things through the process that I never thought I would have to. I thought our justice system was stellar, and it's better than most.
It is.
You know? But to see that truth just doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, I've got a friend in Florida who had a kid that he was gotten involved with in a basketball program, and then he got arrested for something that he didn't really do. And the prosecutors are really coming down on him. And at the end, they come in the last day and they offer him this plea deal. So they won't go to, and they'll get 3 or 4 years or whatever. And then when he turned it down, he said, I didn't do it, man. I'm not going to plead to this. Then they got up and walked out and they never filed charges. They were going to dismiss the charges anyway, knowing he wasn't guilty. But their last shot was at least to put him into prison for 3 or 4 years so people would think they did their job. I mean, it's that kind of actions that gives our justice system a really bad name, and it causes people to lose trust in it.
Yeah.
Which is hurtful. Now, your son grew up, I mean, just reading about James while he was younger, he was a straight-A student. He was accepted into a service academy. I mean, this was a kid that you had every reason to believe was going to succeed, thrive, and do well in life.
He was the cream of the crop. And part of the contrast is, you know, both of my children are just exceptional. And I would have people call me and say, what are you and Anthony doing to raise James and Hannah? Because I want my children to turn out like yours, only to have the whole thing tossed upside down and to feel the shame of what James had become involved in. But he, you know, he had a goal. He looked like he had the world on a string, and very bright and wonderful. We never had any trouble with him. In his teenage years. So this was kind of very unsuspecting. But also, too, I have to say that as a parent, I had confidence that he would make the right choices. And even though he was 21, he still needed to be parented. And I think our children still do, even though they're adults and, you know, they have the jobs and everything. We still need to be actively involved.
Parented in what sense?
In their life.
Parented in what sense do you mean? Because I've always said I threw my kids out at 18 and I stopped parenting them. I wanted to be their friend. I didn't want to be their, because their friend, I could give them advice. I'd give them counsel when they sought it. And I've been very much involved with my kids' lives, I would say, but never pushing my way on them.
Right.
And I think when I see some people parent past 18, they're really trying to still shape the kids in their image, which kids learn to resent. So how do you mean that, Renee?
Right. Oh, I guess what I mean is that I wasn't done yet, that I still needed to check in with him. And, you know, he was still living, you know, at home with us at the time when Tim was murdered. And I saw changes taking place in him and just a depression coming over him, but just kind of figured he'll figure it out. And instead of, I guess, really being, I guess at that time I could have been the friend and stepped in and said, man, what's going on here? They do say that a male's mind does not completely mature until 25. So I think, you know, I think had I known that, it would have made a difference. I would have been more connected.
Sarah's still waiting for mine to mature, but
yeah, I'm still waiting for my husband's too.
It'll take some time for the male brain, unfortunately. In any case, he didn't just go from being a service cat. He got in the service academy. He's going to be a Navy SEAL was his desire, right?
Yes.
And then just for whatever reason, got into that and realized, gosh, it was going to ask more of him, not physically, but in terms of killing another person. He didn't feel like he could do that.
He couldn't do that, which is so ironic.
Yeah, it is.
But then he gets a job. He's back in Fresno, Clovis area. He gets a job. And there's kind of a series of things. It doesn't just become a murderer or an accomplice to murder overnight. It's a series of decisions I notice that kind of, it's gray area. It's an acrimonious divorce going on with the couple he works for. And so he's helping with some property issues and that are problematic. And then he gets caught up in this horrible, horrible murder and then attempt to dispose of the body in a way that no one could find it, hopefully. And
yeah.
And just, boy, you read it as a parent, what parent hasn't thought that, yeah, gee, I hope my kids hang in there and make good choices in their life and not get involved with people that are going to lead him down a difficult path.
Well, when he was acting depressed and all that, you know, you as a parent, you're looking at their friends and it's like, no, he's got really good friends. They have their head on their shoulder and, you know, have a goal in life that they're reaching for. But I never stopped to think it could have been his employer that was the issue. So, and James did make, he made some terrible mistakes. Yeah, he really did. Mm-hmm. And I always think of the scripture in Genesis where God's talking to Cain and he said, be careful, sin's crouching at the door. You must master it. And you just feel like, I felt like for James, that door opened a little bit and the enemy just rushed in and kicked the door wide open.
Yeah. So tell us a little about where he is now. He's in prison for life without parole.
He is.
In California.
Yes.
How often do you guys get to see him?
Well, we've moved to Montana 2 years ago, and I probably get to see him, I aim for twice a year, but it's been 10 months now, I miss him terribly. He does get to call, and so on the weekend, we set that time aside to talk on Saturday and Sunday.
Was part of the move out of California have to do with this, or were other factors that kind of moved you to Montana?
No, it didn't have anything to do with it. It was the hardest part of leaving. My daughter and her family made the move with us. So it's kind of, it was the blaring thing of we're leaving James behind. Hmm. When we sat down and told him we were leaving, that we were going to move to Montana, he just said, you're not going far enough. You should probably leave the country.
Oh my goodness.
And that was during the time when there was so much fear going on and, you know, the prophetic words of America's on the verge of collapse and all that. So
he thought you ought to run further, huh?
Yeah.
Well, you're almost to Canada. You can run across the border if you need to.
Yeah.
Get really bad or anything.
Go somewhere.
How is he doing now? I mean, I love the book. You kind of see this walk that he goes through, even kind of connecting to Jesus again in a different way. And where is he at now?
He is, well, at the time as we speak, it's very difficult because of just some things that we've experienced, the roller coaster effect. And getting his hopes up, he really felt like Governor Brown was going to be signing some commutations that he had applied for and felt like he would be one of them. And then when that didn't happen, he really just... So he's trying to pull himself up is what he's doing. Having a hard time.
Yeah, mostly at the end of terms, governors sign these commutations as they're leaving office so they don't have to pay the political price, I guess, of letting some people off. But his application had gone through quite a process, had gotten to the governor's desk, and all indications were he was going to sign.
Yes.
And then he didn't.
Yeah, exactly. So it was, and you know, I'm trusting the Father with James, even though he's in quite a state of despair. But in the midst of that, just real bad, Julie, when he was in the jail, so just recently arrested, and as things started to unfold, his cry was, I want to know the truth. And he was bright enough to figure out the inconsistencies that the Christian church had taught. And things that just didn't make sense, but he didn't know what. So his thing, I just want to know truth. And where he landed was, he said, you know what? I'm going to make Jesus my standard in sorting it all. Instead of sorting it all out, I'm just going to make him the standard. And whatever he did is what I'm going to do. So I remember... One of the times when he was in prison, we sat down and he said, Mom, Jesus went to the synagogue on Sabbath. He was a Sabbath keeper. And I go, yeah. And he goes, I think we should we should keep Sabbath. Oh no, James, that It doesn't matter, you know. So we entered into this dialogue, and it has really changed a lot of my perspectives about going back and following and using Jesus as our example. So
are you keeping Sabbath now? Is that what that means?
Yeah. And, you know, through this situation, we ended up leaving the traditional church and met with a group of believers at Starbucks for like 8 years and really found community there. When we moved to Montana, I just really didn't think I would go back to traditional church. But I kept going by this little... kept passing this sign, and it was the House of Israel Fellowship, and James kept talking about the feasts and all these things, and I thought, well, I want to go in and see what it looks like, what these feasts look like in this day and age. And we ended up finding an incredible community there of like 60 people that are just wonderful. So we switched over to doing the Sabbath, and
oh my goodness,
it's a huge change, because Saturday night we keep thinking the next day's Monday.
Yeah.
So
it would be a bit of a problem. Let's go back to then how you're coping with all this. Most of these stories, like most of the things, they unfold kind of in, you know, your son's picked up by the police, so it's not too shocking, because the husband is missing of his boss, so maybe he has some information, and you're just thinking, you're not at all. And then as the details unfold, as he's arrested, and I think that goes on and on through your story of this hope sometimes that something good might come out of this, some plea bargain, some help for the prosecution, then it falls apart because they're wanting something he can't give. And How are you dealing with this unfolding story where people are praying that the story will change and it doesn't change in a positive way? It keeps...
Well, even more than that, you talk in the book about these promises that you felt like God had given. And Dad had already told me how the story ended. But I was like, the whole book, but these promises, you know, they're written on a stake and everything. And I was so just like, how do you... have those
How
kinds
do you
of promises,
reconcile it?
Yeah, and then go through what you went through. I feel like those promises were given to you from God, and then go through the road that you did.
A lot of it had to do with, you know, we hear things, and the Father's always right with what he says, but we interpret them wrong. And for me, they were running through the filter of my heart of what I wanted. A lot of it was really falling forward and realizing, you know, you feel like there's a death that's going on inside of you. Inside of me, there was this death going on. But what I cling to was the Father's always right. And I don't understand this situation, but I know he's right. So always being aware that something, an adjustment needed to be made in me. I love the story that Wayne, that you tell about your dad and going through the vineyard and every branch that is laying low or didn't get trimmed, he'll trim and lift it up, and that it's not completed. The process isn't completed until your father walked each row and took care of everything. And I look forward to the day when I know the Father will correct everything and make everything right.
Yeah, one of my favorite passages in 1 Timothy chapter 3, last verse, it's that scripture about, you know, Jesus ascended at the right hand of the Father till all enemies are under his feet. But Eugene Peterson in The Message translates it, Jesus will have the last word on everyone and everything. And to me, that verse gives such hope to the crises and tragedies we face in this world. And somehow going through them, we want him to have it right now. You know, our prayer, our sense of what he might be saying to us is more, we don't really want a God to negotiate the broken places of the world with us. We want a fairy godmother who just waves her magic wand and all our pumpkins turn into chariots and all our rats turn into horses. And I think that's the kind of thing most people have with God. And then they're very angry and disillusioned when it doesn't sort out that way. I've been praying. My friends have been praying. We had this promise from God. Mm-hmm. Not everybody negotiates what you went through and comes out in faith. A lot of people abandon their faith in the midst of their disappointment, in the midst of, I felt like you told me this and you lied to me, God. And I think the triumph of your book is it, no matter what happens to you, you keep coming back to trust this Father who is good enough, wise enough, big enough, and doesn't always do the things I think love would compel him to do. I think that's how wrong we all are. We always think God should do it this way. And if we can have the faith to get past the moments when he doesn't with, okay, God, then what do you have in mind? And now this next thing that we're going to carry, which is a bigger burden than I ever thought I would have to carry, right?
Exactly. And, you know, one of the things about my own father, they talk about, you know, I hear often that the type of father that we have is what we imprint upon our Heavenly Father. And my father was a fix-it guy. He was always there on the scene, no matter what crisis I was having, he would rush in and fix it and make it better. And I know it's completely opposite of what most people experienced, but in my story, what I went through, I was looking for God to come in and make everything okay.
Yeah.
And he didn't. And he gave me, I feel like he empowered me and gave me wisdom and direction in what to do all along the way. And they were very simple, practical things. And I know we love to quote the scripture, he won't give us any more than we can handle. But the second part of that is, but he will provide a way of escape. And it's up to us to learn how to find that way of escape, to make it through what has been thrown on us. Also, too, I feel like he gives us the measure of grace according to what we've been given to walk through.
Yeah, and I would say it's not necessarily up to us to find that way of escape, because that puts a lot of pressure back here, but it's up to us to keep following him and letting him show us that. And I know in my life, I've had a very poor understanding of what I think I could bear, because I'm telling God, man, I can't bear anymore. And amazingly, more happens. And you go, oh, I guess I can. I guess God's grace in me is enough to get me through this next phase. And like so many of our tragedies, they don't usually unfold all at once. They unfold over time, and things you hope will happen don't happen. And so, I think if we keep coming back to, okay, I've got a father who, if I'm under it, whatever pressures that come, they're not greater than I can bear. He's promised that. And two, he has promised me a way out. And in the truest sense of what salvation is, what I think salvation is, you get your get out of hell free card. Salvation is really finding my way into the way God thinks and lives so that I can have the benefits of my relationship with him. I can experience what it is to have a God who leads me through life with joy. But that's really what salvation is. Yes. It's not just a gift that we get and then we just go live however we want. Salvation actually comes from listening and following to this God at work in us and learning to trust his ability to do that, even when we're weak and even when we're deceived, or even, I mean, I tend to think with words we hear from God, and I think about this when I read your book, some of them obviously were God speaking. Others of them were hopes you projected on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what Paul talks about. We see through this glass darkly. We don't see with exact precision. I know we like to think we do. People quote God as if God, they've got 100% tie-in to whatever he's saying or doing. But I find it much more true that in my life, God's insights become clearer over time. You see things, the other things happen, and you're continuing to processing and shaping. What does God mean by that? Is it really him? And some things I get into and go, yeah, that wasn't him. That was just Wayne's best hopes, and I put them on God. Other times, yeah, God was speaking, but like you said, I interpreted it in a way that was completely off the scale from what he had in mind.
Yeah, and then when you look back and it's like, oh, it's exactly what he said, but yeah. It didn't play out the way I wanted. I love the way you articulate things, Wayne. You do it so sweet, good. I think one of the biggest things that I stumbled over was the things when God wasn't playing the role that I gave him. My English is bad.
Yeah.
You know, we have these expectations or things that we had learned, you know, and they ended up being a stumbling block. So stripping them off and coming into the reality of his love for me, his unchanging love for me,
yeah.
And his presence. And a lot of the times I thought, if anything else, the thing that I'm thankful for the most is his presence.
Yeah.
I think stopping and finding that in the midst of agony is my way, is the way of escape that he has shown me, you know, is just to know he's there with me, guiding, directing.
That's why it's so important. We don't push him away with, you didn't do what I wanted, so now I'm angry. Because, boy, our only hope is finding our way back through our hurts, through our disappointments, finding ourselves back inside his love and care, our awareness of that love and care, and then being able to follow what he gives us next. I think that's the only hope that we have. Through the things yeah. that we face.
It is.
Yeah. Let's go back to some of what you shared in the beginning. You talked about the shame, the embarrassment. I've made the statement often. I think we turn parenting in Christian environments oftentimes, we turn parenting into a competition sport. Mm. So we take our identity by how well our kids are doing. And you also mentioned you weren't traditionally in a church setting through some of this time. How much of that shame, embarrassment, judgment did you feel from other Christians or project on yourself? Was that a big part of it? Because I know when Julie screwed up as a kid, I'd always be... No, I'm kidding.
Okay, Julie. Oh, goodness. What are you going to do?
Oh, it's his birthday. You can't whack on him. Yeah. Right?
I'm thinking about it.
Oh, I'm glad you're far enough away you can't reach me.
You got a spitball or something there that you could...
long stick.
I mean, did you feel some of that from the larger Christian community, or did that not bother you?
No, I didn't. In fact, the big thing was that they were looking at us and taking an inventory of them, their own lives and their own way of parenting. They thought if that can happen to Anthony and Relaine, it could happen to us. So it caused a lot of conversations with other parents. It kind of caused them to have conversations with their kids, knowing that they were vulnerable too.
So when you talk about shame, then were you blaming yourself that you might have done something wrong that would have caused this?
You know,
where did that shame hit for you?
Well, the shame came from my own judgments, you know, of watching the news and seeing moms, you know, on camera crying about how he's such a sweet boy, he's innocent, and just accusing them of your son's there because of the kind of parent you were.
Yeah.
And so it was really the shame of my own judgment that I had made. And,
okay.
And then realizing I was a good parent. And here I am. And I probably have those other, I have other women like me, you know, pointing their finger at the TV thinking James didn't have a good mother. And
oftentimes that's what we want to believe, right? I when I worked at an airport, I noticed that. If a plane crashes, it's got to be pilot error. We want to believe it's always in our control. Yeah. If we do everything right, everything's going to work out wonderfully well. And the fact is, life doesn't work that way. And, you know, even God's, you know, they talk about even God doesn't have a great track record with parenting. The two purest kids you put on the planet didn't do well. Anyway, God gave us free will. God gave us a lot of options. And Julie and I talked in the last podcast we did about It's not our task to change our children. We can't make perfect children. They're broken. They're in a broken world. We can love them, hopefully draw them into the space where God can be part of their lives. But we, no matter what we do in parenting, we can't determine the outcome of our children's lives. That's not in our purview to do. And yet we somehow feel like it should be. We should be able to do that. And parents blame each other at times like that. And, you know, gosh.
It's true.
Yeah. I think that's what makes parenting difficult in the world, because we don't support each other when someone has a prodigal son, child, kid that gets into some kind of trouble. We kind of want to judge them and think, if I do better, that won't happen to me. And that's the lie that I think
it
really
is.
Devastates a lot of people when this kind of tragedy hits.
I think that's what made it hard for me, is I believed the lie. And then to be free of that lie, you know, it's letting go of the things that you thought were true or no longer true, and then embracing what is true.
Yeah.
It's a whole different, it is a journey.
Yeah.
And it's not, in my book, I think, Julie, one of the things that I wanted to tell you is it's not messy. I mean, it is messy, that walk of believing and hoping and then not getting it. And it's not easy. Standing on a promise and believing it is messy. We think it's going to be magical and easy, and it's not. It all does a work in us to conform us into the image of Christ.
Yeah, and I love how you just kind of said, God, I just give you James, and I give you these promises. And I think even the book you said, you don't owe me anything, but I'm just giving this to you. And you just rested in just Father's love and trusted that he had James and he had you guys in the middle of that. And I feel like that definitely played out through the book, and just how simple that was in the middle of all of these tragic circumstances. You seem just to keep drawing to just, I'm going to give this to you, and I'm going to trust that somewhere in here, you're going to walk me through this. There was that footprints in the sand thing it's not footprints in the sand. We're just going to walk this together. And I just thought that was such a beautiful image.
Oh, thank you.
And I don't want to go over that too fast, because I think, to me, that's what the prayer of faith is. We interpreted scripture, the prayer of faith is, I'm praying for this outcome. And you hear people talk about, I'm trusting God for this healing, or I'm trusting God for that court case. I'm trusting God for this. When you're trusting God for something, you're not ultimately trusting God. That prayer of faith that says, I put all of my life in your hands. I put the people I love in your hands. I'm going to trust you. I want to listen, follow, live inside that. But I'm not demanding, or I'm not trusting you, God, to give me the outcome that I think is the only loving outcome. And if we're focused on that outcome, we are going to always struggle, because God almost rarely does the things I think he should do in a given situation or circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll say, like you, when I turn around, he always has the best thing in mind. He's looking way down range. I'm mostly just thinking about my personal comfort, and I want relief, and I want out of whatever's going on. And God's just, there's so many other things going on. And growing you up is one of those things that I not use circumstances to do, but I'm not going to just get you out of things because they're uncomfortable, because a lot of growth comes in the discomfort of life.
You know, that is so true. And it just really speaks to one of the matters that the Father's put on my heart in reading in Revelation. It seems like Jesus is saying over and over again, those that endure till the end will be saved. And just, he repeats it over and over again. And I think about, the only way to learn how to endure is to be in the midst of something for a very long time. And that to see it as a benefit, you know, was it Paul? Who said, count it all joy? Was it Paul or Peter?
It was Jesus, you know, actually said in the Sermon on the Mount.
When you enter into various trials
and people lie about you, insult you, exclude you.
Oh, yeah. That one too. You know,
right.
So it's having a paradigm change of, okay, this will make me better. It's a kingdom perspective. And how else are we going to endure and make it through those trials unless we're in them? And so I instead of running, I don't know that I ever really want to run to a trial.
Yeah, me either. Yeah. I don't volunteer for that ever.
But when they come, you know, why not see it as an opportunity?
Yep. Yeah, I think that's good. It's what you have to do, because tragedies are going to come. And when they do, particularly when in this kind of thing, when it's unfolding in darker ways than you could ever imagine at the beginning. And it just keeps, it just doesn't get better for
and
a
then,
long season.
And then we reach for our formulas, right?
Yeah.
And they don't work. And when I went to write Burden of Promise, I thought formulas didn't work for me. So I don't want to give other people a book of formulas. So this is what you should do. Right. So the way I wrote it was basically, this worked for me. It might work for you. There might be some wisdom here, but I don't want people to feel like they're getting the ABCs of how to make it through difficulty.
Sure.
So.
But the main lesson is just, which I think is true for all of us, just keep leaning into God's arms when you're beyond yourself and in pain and don't know what to do. Don't turn on him, because he's our only hope. So you just keep leaning into that space. Well, I think you've done the world a gift, Elaine, which is why I wanted to have you on here. I just,
Wayne, thank you.
To give that kind of story so honestly told and in the middle of it, I think it's a real hope for other people that no matter what I'm going through, God's big enough to do it. I put a post on my blog a week or so ago from a lady who just found out her husband become an atheist and then leaves her after 16 years, she said, of being treated every way a woman would want to be treated. And her husband leaves her. And in the middle of all that, she finds God in such an amazing way. And
I read that.
Yeah, it's just crazy what God does in the midst of our brokenness if we keep leaning that direction.
And you know, if you're gonna fall forward.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Hey, just real quick, one of the recommendations when I had talked with you about writing a book, and I think I had sent you part of my manuscript, you said, the conversations with God are kind of difficult, you know. So I worked really hard to make them.
Wow.
Well, I think it was that people would find them unrelatable.
Yep.
You know, so I worked really hard to try that. But the Father's gift to me was my writing group that helped me process through this. And we're such a diverse group. And I didn't realize how entrenched I was in my Christian faith until the atheist in the group would say, you wrote, and I'd do something that Christians say that I thought everybody would understand. She goes, what does that mean? And so I would explain it to her. She goes, well, you need to write that because I have no idea what you're talking about. So I love to tell people that my book is atheist approved.
Oh, okay.
I wanted to write it in a way that even a person that is not acquainted with spiritual things could pick it up and read it and kind of go, I haven't experienced that, but I think I know what they're talking about. I wrote it in that way because I'm aware of the high profile case that there would be people interested just in the crime factor alone.
Sure.
My hope is that they'll pick it up for that. And in the midst, find that there's this wonderful Father that walks with us. And loves us and cares for us and has our best always at heart. So I'm glad I endured to do it. And it did take 15 years to get the perspective of it all, really. That's probably why it took so long to sort through the things and
leave it there. And if you wrote in another 15 years, your perspective will even be different again.
Yeah, I'm sure it will be.
But thanks for joining us today, Relaine. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much.
All righty.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.